From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we'll explore Wisconsin's immigrant history and our perception of Latino communities.
We talk about Latino immigrants as being newcomers, as being exotic, as being strangers in communities, as opposed to thinking of them as being another chapter in Wisconsin's long history of immigrant belonging and immigrant making into this space.
Then we'll hear a conversation with young Latina women who are working towards an inclusive future and fighting for the rights of undocumented people.
I've told this to many people who are undocumented and are DACA recipients who have said, I don't want to put myself up there and say I'm undocumented because then now I'm a target. And I've told them, you're a target either way.
Plus, we'll speak with the director of the film Unseen on the life of a blind undocumented immigrant. All that's coming up on Lake Effect, but first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thank you so much for joining us today. Although Latino people have lived in Wisconsin nearly as long as it's been a state, historian Sergio Gonzalez says Latino communities are often seen as being perpetual outsiders. Gonzalez is the author of Mexicans in Wisconsin and Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin. His work explores how Latinos have integrated into Wisconsin communities, the impact of cultural exchange, and perceptions of immigrants. He joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about the history of Latino immigration in Wisconsin and what it looks like today.
Often when we talk about Wisconsin's Latino community, we talk about it in a couple key ways, as both a monolith and as a relatively new history, kind of from the 1990s onward. This book really dispels both of these notions. When do Latinos first start coming to Wisconsin?
Well, you know, the first recorded Latino, the one that we have historical record of, goes all the way back to the 19th century. But the large numbers of Latino settling here really begins in the 1920s, when Mexican industrial workers were recruited to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to serve as workers in tanneries, factories, and foundries. And in many ways, they were just kind of following the footsteps of the European immigrants who had preceded them. They were coming here as cheap, controllable labor. Oftentimes, they were brought as strikebreakers without their knowledge. And so they had a really tough go of it trying to find a space to live in Wisconsin, trying to find work sites that paid them well, that treated them well. And it was not a very easy experience for them. Again, an experience that's very similar to other groups that have preceded them before.
One of the key words of this book is hospitality. And it's a word that you use in a kind of interesting way. When you say hospitality, what do you mean?
Well, you know, I think all Midwesterners have an understanding of hospitality. The way that it comes to us most is the idea of Midwestern nice, and every state has kind of its own version of it, whether it's Wisconsin nice or Minnesota nice. We like to think of ourselves as welcoming people. And I think in many ways, Wisconsinites have been welcoming to Latinos across the 20th century. But there are so many instances where Latino immigrants, migrants, and refugees have struggled to find a sense of welcome here. I like to think of welcoming as not just saying hello to somebody and bringing them into the table, but also offering them political power, social space, economic power as well. And so there's an entire field of study called hospitality studies that tries to understand the interaction between the person who is the in-group and those who kind of exist at the boundaries and kind of the conflicts, the tensions that arise when those out-group members try to become members of the in-group. And for the history of Latinos here in the state of Wisconsin, there has been a constant tension. We have moments of great community, of great collaboration between different communities, but also moments where there has been friction. And I think into the 21st century, we see that we're still working out a lot of those questions.
One of the ways that you describe this is the idea of the perpetual stranger, this idea that, I'll have you explain it.
Yeah. I mean, this is, for me, the framing of the book, of course, it's a question not just of Latinos arriving in Wisconsin, but how they've built community. And I look at the question of faith, specifically faith spaces and houses of worship. And within both the Old and New Testament, there's this constant evocation of the stranger and the obligation to the stranger, how Christians and Jews are supposed to welcome the person who exists at the gate. Now, the question, of course, becomes is if that person who is at the gate is consistently going to exist at the threshold of belonging, will they ever have an opportunity to actually be a full member of the community? And so I'm interested in, you know, as the book of Ephesians says, how can people become strangers no longer in a community they've called home for 100 years? And as I kind of note in the book, there's really an unresolved question here in whether or not Latinos are full members of their communities here in Wisconsin. I think many Latinos would call themselves Wisconsinites. I certainly do. I was born and raised here in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But there is a constant tension of feeling, do I completely belong and do people want me to be here?
As you said, in the book, you really explore this through the church's relationship with Latino communities, going back to when Latinos originally come to Wisconsin. How did churches, parishes initially welcome these new migrants?
Yeah, I love the beginning of the story because I think it throws a lot of us for a loop. We might think of this kind of a progressive history of Latinos arriving as very difficult at the beginning, and it gets better across the 20th century. But actually, perhaps the best moments of welcome, of integration, happened in the 1920s when Latinos arrive. They find a lot of friction in their workspaces and social spaces. They settle on the city's south side. But the place where they find a home is in their churches, specifically Catholic churches. And it's white Catholics on the city's south side, specifically at Holy Trinity Church, who open the doors and welcome into the pews these Mexican Catholics who are arriving into the city. And it's that shared sense of Catholicism, right? The shared faith that exists between the two groups, even if they speak a different language, they have different cultures, they have different ways of knowing this city, that they find a sense of communion, a sense of fellowship. And so some of the most robust senses of collaboration that happen among Latino newcomers and Milwaukeeans is in developing a Mexican mission chapel on 5th and National. And that building still exists here in Milwaukee in the Walker's Point neighborhood. Eventually, that church migrates into the Holy Trinity Church. And we now recognize it, of course, as Holy Trinity Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is really the heart of Latino Catholicism here in Milwaukee.
This relationship really does change through the decades. How do we see this evolve over time? When Latinos, of course, the communities that are here are also changing. We're getting new people in. But also the people who had been here initially are really have set down roots, have created communities. How does this relationship to the church change?
Yeah, well, I'm glad that you mentioned at the start of our conversation the fact that Latinos are not a monolith. And this is kind of represented in the different groups that arrive in Wisconsin at different points throughout the 20th century. So Mexican immigrants arrive in the 1920s. The group that follows them are Texas Mexican Americans. So these are American citizens who are born at the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. And they come to Wisconsin to do migrant work in the 1940s through the 1970s. Their experiences are very different because they're arriving in rural Wisconsin. They're here very much temporarily from the spring through the fall. And eventually many of them settle here in places like Milwaukee, Madison, Kenosha, Racine. They're followed by groups like Puerto Rican industrial workers who are American citizens, but they're still treated like outsiders in many ways. They arrive here in Milwaukee as industrial workers in the 1950s. And then, of course, Cuban refugees in the 1960s and the 1980s and Central American refugees who are arriving in the 1980s who are fleeing persecution but find a limited sense of political harbor here in Wisconsin. And so all of these different groups, even though they fall under the large umbrella of Latino, Hispanic, Latinx, Latine, are having different experiences with the people who arrive here and different experiences with those established Latinos who have been here perhaps for decades before.
Now, your book explores how churches not only served as a place of worship, but also often a center for political and activist organization. How did that develop?
It was, I would say, very organic, and I think it's an experience that many people have with their churches. These are not just places of worship where they can pray to their Lord, where they can practice the scriptural teaching, where they can have a sense of community with people who are like-minded in their faith. It's also a place that can serve as a social service agency, a place of education, not just parochial schools, but, you know, people learning English. And then ultimately can also be a place for political empowerment and political mobilization. So there are different moments where this happens. Of course, in the 1920s, those first Mexican migrants who arrive here, some of them are political refugees who are arriving from Mexico fleeing persecution because of their faith during a period that was known as the Cristero War in Mexico when the Mexican state went to war with the Mexican Catholic Church. And that extends into the 1960s, migrant farm workers who turned to their churches to organize their labor unions and to boycott grapes to support migrant farm workers across the United States. And then, of course, maybe most dramatically in the 1980s with the birth of the sanctuary movement, where churches literally become places of safe harbor for political refugees fleeing persecution in El Salvador and Guatemala. And Milwaukee serves as a central hub for the sanctuary movement beginning in December of 1982 and extending all the way through the 1980s. And I think today we can still see this to this day, where Latinos turn to their churches for a number of different reasons. Again, as a place of solace, a place of fellowship, a place of faith, but also as a place of political mobilization.
Now, this is a book that was, in some ways, really born out of your desire to add to this history where there really wasn't a lot that was in a collected space. You start the book, of course, with a story about going to the library, asking for, you know, all the materials on Latino history in Milwaukee, and then finding a photo of yourself, of course.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a stunning story. You know, you have these existential moments when you say, am I doing what I'm supposed to be doing with my life? And my first experience in the archives as a young graduate student was to literally find myself in the first document that I pulled out of a box. It was, you know, obviously hair-raising, and it kind of really shook me. But then I put my historian's hat on, and I got to thinking about a few different things. One, the fact that there was such a limited number of archives that have been preserved about my community. And I got to thinking, what does it mean that our historical societies, our libraries, our historians have done such a pitiful job of commemorating a history that I believe is central not just to our past as a state, but is fundamental to understanding where we're going as a state moving forward. And then I got to thinking, of course, what does it mean when I pull this first image out of the box? It was a picture of me and my parents and my family walking out of a church. And that really oriented my understanding of what it means to create community, right? Looking at these different institutions that can exist in many different varieties, not just as places of worship, but of social services and of political mobilization. I'm really fortunate today that I'm not doing this work by myself. There's a growing network of Latino historians across Wisconsin, across the Midwest, who are trying to put our region on the map, right? To say that, of course, we have to focus on the Southwest, in New York City, and Miami, where there are these large Latino populations. But the fastest growing Latino populations are in the U.S. South and the U.S. Midwest. And here in Wisconsin, of course, we can look at any number of urban areas or rural areas and know that absent Latino growth and absent Latino populations, we would see net demographic decline. And so we are literally the future of the state in so many different ways. It's imperative for us to look to the past, to rectify these archival accidents, archival problems, archival lackings, and fill them in with the histories of this community.
Sergio, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect.
Thank you, Joy. I appreciate it.
Con el programa Bracero, la esclavitud moderniza.
Sergio Gonzalez is an assistant professor of history at Marquette University and the author of the books Strangers No Longer, Latino Belonging and Faith in 20th Century Wisconsin, and Mexicans in Wisconsin. He spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers late last year. There's been a flurry of news lately about immigration and people without legal status. But that hasn't stopped advocates and organizers from doing their work. We'll hear now from two organizers from the young adult movement called Comité Sin Fronteras, or Committee Without Borders, who are committed to advocating for immigration reform. Here's Fernanda Jimenez and Daisy España.
Well, my name is Fernanda, and I'm a DACA recipient. But I do like to mention that I'm undocumented, protected under DACA temporarily, because we know that DACA has only been a temporary fix in the immigration system and is in limbo. On the side, on my own time, I am the founder of Comité Sin Fronteras and one of the leading organizers now with my comrades, and I like to call friends because they're more than comrades now.
My name is Daisy España. I am 22. I am a member of Comité Sin Fronteras and Voces de la Frontera. I'm an organizer. I've been able to establish pretty good relationships with organizations in Milwaukee and across the state. Last fall, I ran for assembly. I didn't win, but that's okay. I'll do it again. I think I'm one of only, is it two or three U.S. citizens in the committee? I think you're just one of two.
Yeah. So we do joke. We joke about how Daisy is for the people. And as much as it's a joke, or we carry it as a joke, we know it's not a joke. If ICE is in 13th and Lapham and Daisy hears about it, Daisy is there. She'll say, bet, I'm going. And she does. So my question to you is, why is it and how And where does the bravery come from for you to be so committed and devoted to the work that you do?
Just to backtrack, for the people. So that was my slogan when I ran for assembly. I mean, it's still for the people. I got shirts and everything, right? So, I mean, I can point at different stories or situations throughout, like, my upbringing. My parents are from Mexico, and my dad's still undocumented. My mom became a permanent resident a little over a year and a half ago. But growing up, I constantly heard, like, my parents talk about, don't open the door to anybody, even if they're your tia or your sister. Like, don't open the door, right? And I'm like, damn, like, I gotta keep my sister outside. But in reality, it was because of fear, right? Like, specifically, there's this one time when we were kids. We were coming back from Chicago, and a sheriff stopped my dad. All of a sudden, I see my mom, like, starts praying. And she says, like, out loud that she hopes that they give him, like, the most expensive ticket ever, but not that she sees, like, a nice car or vehicle. And to me, I was like, what the heck? Just something is not right. Mm. And then obviously growing up on the South Side, the differences between the South Side and the East Side, or there was this one time, there was like a block party, and I was hanging out with the cops. And I was like, what's up, you know? And my mom got so mad. She's like, why are you doing that? Like, they're not, you know, they're not there to, like, protect you. And I was like, what do you mean? Like, that's their job. And so when you ask about, like, where does that bravery come from? I mean, don't get me wrong. It's a bit nerve-wracking, too. You know, like, I'll say, like, I'm there, right? And I'm, like, nervous. But I still go because it's, like, someone taught me that the most impactful piece of protest that you have is, like, your body. And to me, it's, like, nothing that I'll ever do will compare to the struggle and fear and experiences that the immigrant community faces. So the least I could do is, like, stand in front of an ICE agent to protect my friends and family and community. I tell people all the time when they're afraid to, like, organize. Mm-hmm. Like, who's going to do it if you don't? Like,
there's nothing has been given to you.
Yeah.
We think about all of the different policies that are pro-immigrant, and people are grateful for them, and they really think, like, oh, the government gave it to us, or Obama gave this to us. And it's never the case that just because they were in office, they gave it to you. It was always fought by people so that that policy would have been implemented. I mean, we've talked about DACA being that way. Many DACA recipients think that Obama passed that executive order because he wanted to. I'm not saying he didn't, but it took a lot of work for him to agree on passing that as an executive order. And it was all by the people. There was people like around our age who fought for the DREAM Act, didn't go through, and then DACA was able to happen. And now, I mean, like myself, I have DACA and I'm able to work legally and have some protection, some, in this country. But it's all by us. And that's honestly how I think immigration reform is going to happen.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be by the people. And it's only going to be a push for them to actually say, you know what? Yeah, sure. What the heck? Yeah. What the
heck? No, yeah. But speaking about for the people, with the people, by the people, and I don't think I've asked you this ever, for that matter. But you mentioned, I mean, you're a DACA recipient. You are protected to an extent, but you essentially are undocumented, and you're still, like, you founded Comité. You say yes to, like, putting your picture out there. You, like, you really don't care. Like I don't care. But homegirl, like, you're, like, undocumented, and I guess my question is, if you can talk about how you feel as somebody who's undocumented. But on top of that, how you feel as somebody who's undocumented, who is at the forefront of this movement, trying to get other undocumented folks to be involved when there's just a lot of, like, fear.
I'll start off by saying I'm a natural anxious person, and I've been diagnosed with anxiety, where my therapist has said, you were just born anxious, and you that's just who you are. So, like, to me, I've always been anxious and afraid. Like, you can't say that I am 100% unafraid. I am. I'm afraid for myself, obviously, happening the worst case scenario. I'm afraid for my parents, who are a lot more vulnerable than me. I'm afraid for the people who are a lot more vulnerable than my parents. And even if I don't know them, they're my community. And I do fear for the worst case scenario. But I also think that living in fear just makes your life completely worse, and it doesn't do anything to progress for what we're trying to solve. And I think only being in community keeps you so safe. If you don't have a community, you're in a much more difficult situation.
Yeah.
I've told this to many people who are undocumented and are DACA recipients who have said, like, well, like, I don't want to put myself up there and say I'm undocumented because then now I'm a target. And I've told them, it's like, you're a target either way. Even not saying it up front and to, you know, on the news or whatever, or just like to people in public, you're a target. If you're a DACA recipient, your information has been given to the government already. So you're already seen as undocumented. And if DACA is taken away, you're undocumented now. If you have been in other places that you said you're undocumented, you're already out there. Your status is out there. And when you don't have community and something were to happen to you, that's when it makes it difficult to protect you. And if you had community, then you're much harder to target. And without community, someone who is not out there, they would have been easily detained and easily deported. And I think that's really what's kept me just going. I'm afraid. I'm always afraid. Mm-hmm. I'm like a little chihuahua. if I was a pet, I'd be a chihuahua because that's how much I shake. Oh. I shake now. But I really think that the community and the people around me keep me going and make me feel that being afraid isn't going to get us anywhere or me anywhere. And now I feel like I'm not alone. We're talking about all this, you know, fear and like how we've been trying to get away from fear. We've been trying to be more hopeful and to organize our communities more so that we can really get to what the final solution is and our goal, which is a pathway to citizenship, but also what happens after a pathway to citizenship. Like what's the fight? The fight's going to be continuous. The solution is not just immigration reform. There's so much to immigration and to immigrants because everything is intersectional. So I'm wondering, how do you envision the world in the immigrant rights movement in the future and beyond what we are seeing now?
Yeah. Has anyone seen the Hunger Games? no, but I think how I like to see it is from the bottom up, mm-hmm. where it's like, how do we first win, like at the county mm-hmm. level and then at the city level and then the mm-hmm. state level, right? Like, sure, you know, how many years have we been, like, pushing for a pathway to citizenship? Mm-hmm. Even when we had the House of Representatives, mm-hmm. the Senate, and the White House controlled mm-hmm. by the Democrats, and nothing was passed.
Mm-hmm. We're right? so close. One vote away.
Super close. Obviously, we'll keep organizing. Obviously, we'll keep marching and protesting and calling our Congress people and, you know, you name it. That won't stop, but I think, like, my thing has always been, like, local government. So my job now is to recruit mm-hmm. people to run for office. The time frame, I'm not sure, because, like you said, you know, we think about the next 4 years, and it's kind of like, oof, where is the political and economic state of the world going to be? You know what I mean? Are we going to lose people? Mm. We can have this plan, but we won't know until mm-hmm. we're there, mm-hmm. right? And so right now, I think we're having an influx of people who are, like, calling us or wanting to be involved. I mean, like, our posts are getting an insane amount of shares. So it's doing good right now. But we've seen it with, like, the May Day marches, right? Mm-hmm. Since 2007, we've been fighting to reinstate driver's license. Mm-hmm. And every single year, we march. Mm-hmm. And every single year, you see a decrease of people. And it's not because people don't want to march or don't want to fight. It's, like, people are tired. Mm-hmm. And so how many years can go by before you start losing people?
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
But I think, like, what you were saying about people are tired, mm-hmm. I agree. People are tired. And that's why I believe that our generation that needs investment in what leadership looks like, and you said it perfectly. I mean, locally, we need to get those people in office, mm-hmm. And that'll take time. But education is so crucial now, and I think we have the people in the room. Yeah. It's just bringing out that education to them and really implementing it all over. And even, I think, like, internationally, like, we see that it's not just a national issue.
Yeah.
It's an international issue of immigration being such a stigma. They're not treated fairly. They're not treated like humans. Yeah, I fully agree with you. I think there's going to be a lot of work. People are tired, and we need to give them a moment to be tired, too.
Yeah.
We can't just make them fight all the time, because I get tired.
Right.
I'm tired right now.
I'm about to take a nap.
Matter of fact. Yeah. But, yeah, I think it's okay to be tired.
Yeah.
And there's always going to be someone who is going to be working for you and with you.
Yeah.
And that's really what matters.
Yeah, it's like, take your time.
Yeah.
We'll hold it down for right now.
We got it.
But then you're going to, like...
Yes.
You come in and then let me take a break.
Right, right.
You know what I mean?
Tag team.
Tag team. Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's how we win.
That's right.
That was Fernanda Jimenez, founder of Comité Sin Fronteras, and Daisy España, an organizer with Comité Sin Fronteras and Voces de la Frontera. That group chat was produced by WUWM's Jimmy Gutierrez and first aired in February. Did you know you can listen to Like Effect as a podcast? Search for Like Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Later in the show, we'll speak with the director of the documentary Unseen, which follows the life of a blind, undocumented immigrant in America. But first, we'll learn how a care center in Milwaukee is helping Spanish speakers who are suffering from memory loss. That's coming up next on Like Effect on WUWM. You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Latinos are 1.5 times more likely than non-Hispanic whites to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. On average, they're also diagnosed at a younger age. That's a disparity that the care teams at the United Community Center in Milwaukee are trying to address. It houses the only memory clinic in Wisconsin focused on testing patients for Alzheimer's and dementia in Spanish. WUWM's Mayon Silver spoke with Dr. Pierre Antuano, a neurology professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin, who works at the Latino Geriatric Center.
Why is it important to be able to diagnose people with memory issues in Spanish?
Yes. So first of all, I think knowing what's the cause of a memory problem is very important, because that, as you might know, is part of a normal aging. That has to be dissected, separated from something which is more ominous for the future, such as a dementia or Alzheimer disease, or maybe dementia is caused due to vascular disease or other causes, which could be even be treatable. And because the evaluations, the assessments are done two ways in parallel. One, asking the caregiver, the family, the people who know the patient, what are the nature of the changes they have noticed. And these changes are behavior. They are personality changes. They are changes in character, in temperament. And you have to really understand what's the baseline on an individual before making an assessment to say, oh, this is a relative change, which is a sign of a change, an organic change happening in the brain. You need to have this done in the mother tongue of the family and the patient to really get the nuances of these changes. Because it could be somebody who has no education, is illiterate, and their change are going to be very different from somebody who has PhD and a Nobel Prize, and their changes are going to be shown in a very different environment, a very different context. So you need to take those nuances. Once we know that information and we decide to do a memory test, of course, we need to do a memory test in their mother tongue, because, again, the subtleties of the memory test are really based on their knowledge, their cultural background, their cultural background, which limits to some degree some of the kind of questions. For instance, to give you an example, I ask them to interpret proverbs, because proverbs, if you can interpret proverbs, tells me how abstract you can reason or what's your judgment in explaining a certain context. But that is dependent if you ever knew these proverbs, but if you ever heard them before, and if you have low education, you probably haven't read much and you're not aware of these proverbs. So I'm going to tell you a proverb in English translated in Spanish is not going to make any sense whatsoever. I need to use examples in their culture. Discovered myself in this work that we say Hispanic, Latinos, but actually the Mexican culture is very different from Puerto Rico, from Central America, and from South America. And we tend to be very generalized in regards even to our own specific question, in regards to address people in a cultural competent manner. But going back to your original question, the memory tests are done in their own language because one have to make sure that they understand the question or the problem so that we can rely on a diagnosis that their answers, whether they're wrong or bad, are correct for us to make the next step, which is a diagnosis.
I was told that this is the only Spanish-speaking diagnostic memory clinic in the state of Wisconsin. Is that the case? And if so, what happens to people that can't access the clinic and speak Spanish and are potentially having memory issues?
Okay, so in most centers, there is ability of finding an interpreter through a computer system, and that is kind of provided routinely, not only within the Hispanic population, but of course other languages. So that would be probably the way that a lot of locations up north or maybe Dane County might deal with, unless they're blessed to have Spanish-speaking staff at their institution. That's how it's generally done. And we have now received basically funding through colleagues at the University of Wisconsin to actually expand from Milwaukee to the counties around us. So yes, the ambition is to extend this even at the statewide, and their efforts in writing grants to get funding to move in that direction with Madison.
So let's say somebody comes into the clinic, their family members bring them in, and you give them a diagnostic test, and it comes up that they have suspected dementia or Alzheimer's. First of all, can you explain just in a, very briefly what is Alzheimer's and dementia? And then secondly, what happens next after somebody is diagnosed?
Yes, so if we find signs which are suggestive of dementia, our task is really identify the cause of dementia, because dementia is like having a headache. You can have a headache because you have wrong glasses, because you have a brain tumor, because you're depressed. There's so many other causes. The same thing with dementia. You can have dementia, which means loss of cognitive ability of different types. The cause can be multiple. It could be poor nutrition. It could be an endocrine problem. It could be a brain tumor, it could be depression, anxiety, or it could be actually Alzheimer's disease, which is a relatively common presentation in the elderly who before that did not have memory problems. Once we know the type of dementia, then we can decide what are we going to do about it. Before COVID, a nurse and social worker would actually visit the family and the patient at home, which is an important part of the evaluation, because we have a sense of their environment, their living situation, and in managing dementia, that aspect is extremely important because, as I mentioned originally, we have different level of education, different levels of occupation, and we need to blend and fit into that real life environment to see if we can avoid safety risks. You know, is the person driving? Is the person cooking? Have a real, hands-on and visual in regards to what's the household like and who is around to provide help. So we try to address safety issues. We try to anticipate potential problems that might occur so that the family, when they might see aggressiveness, irritability, apathy, insomnia, all of these kind of symptoms which accompany dementia, might be prepared to face them, because we want to make sure the caregiver is strong enough to stay there and provide the help for the patient without themselves, of course, becoming depressed, becoming tired, and because they frequently have to still work, and so they are pulled in many directions, but to provide them that support. And we do that through education and anticipation planning in many ways. Then we also use medications that can help memory in some cases.
And why is it better for people with diagnoses of dementia and Alzheimer's to be in a social environment? And why is that important for Latinos diagnosed with this illness to have access to programming that highlights the diversity of the Hispanic world?
Yes, the social aspect of managing dementia is extremely important because we are social animals. And we may be demented and I might forget what your name is, but I can still emotionally relate to you by looking at your facial expression, by the tone of your voice, by the kindness. Am I in a good place or not? people with advanced dementia still perceive that. So creating a social environment that's conducive to the person's well-being and quality of life is essential. And the socialization provided by an adult daycare center has to be culturally appropriate. For instance, your culture is your food and your language. So for instance, those are the first visible thing that one will appreciate being in this environment. Because remember that people who have dementia don't like new things because their problem is not remembering. The problem is storing new information. So we place them in a place with a bunch of strangers doing music and whatever's happening. This is too confusing. Take me back to my armchair in my home and leave me there, which we don't want to do, but that's what the patient would like us to do. After the first shock, I would say, of this new environment, they eventually becomes their new normal activity. So to the point that they look forward to it. The benefit is also that we also provide in the family for respite so that they can go to work, they can go in to the hairdresser, they can live hopefully a sort of a more normal life with more reserve so they can last longer doing what they're doing.
It really is amazing how certain activities, even if someone is having the dilution of some brain function, that there are activities that they can grab onto and still do.
It's true. In fact, we need to know that carefully because those early life experiences that you have made educationally, professionally, and personally are very important because now that your memory and your world around you is becoming fragmented and you're hanging on to these bits and pieces that you, from your past, those bits and pieces are very important for us to highlight and know exactly, you know, this person is a retired engineer, very different from an 85-year-old retired housewife. You know, so we need to, so with one guy, with the guy, we'll talk about your job, your work, and they'll remember that because that early life experiences are retained well. With the 85-year-old retired housewife, we'll probably talk about their grandkids because that's her world. So we need to know where they come from. To give you an example, there was a gentleman who worked with the railways, with the train, with trains, caboose and things like that, and he was very agitated. So somebody in the group had this idea about buying a coffee table book about trains. And we would open this book and he would look at all these trains and he knew everything about these trains and where he worked and the kind of a role of the guy who's in the caboose versus the guy who's driving the train. The following day he gets agitated again. He says, "Hey, I have something for you." And oh my God, he never saw that book before. And we start all over again. And that was enough, no medication, nothing, that to really make him. But knowing that past allowed us to know how to manage his concerns today.
Amazing, amazing. Well, thanks for sharing this information about dementia and about the Latino Geriatric Center, Dr. Antuano, and best wishes.
Well, thank you.
Dr. Piero Antuano is a neurology professor at the Medical College of Wisconsin who works at the United Community Center. He spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver in 2022. We'll take one more break, and when we come back, we'll tell you about Unseen, a documentary that follows an undocumented immigrant living with a disability. Keep listening to Like Effect on Milwaukee's NPR. This is Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Most people dream of a better future, and Pedro, an aspiring social worker, is no different. However, as a blind, undocumented immigrant, he faces obstacles to get his college degree, secure a job, and support his family. Pedro's story is the focus of the documentary called Unseen. Through experimental cinematography and sound, the documentary reimagines accessibility in cinema while exploring the intersections of immigration, disability, and mental health. Unseen's director and producer Seth Hernandez joins me now to talk about the film. Now, I want to start talking about the opening sequence and how it truly sets the audience up in one of the most unique ways I've experienced. And it begins with the film. It's a bit bright, the picture's blurred, and your brain kind of automatically waits for it to focus, right? But then it doesn't. So can you share a bit more on how you decided to set the tone and keep it this way? Had you seen this technique done before?
For the most part, I was making the film because I wanted Pedro to be able to enjoy the film, not in a lesser way than anybody that's cited, for example, but because the story is about Pedro, I wanted Pedro to feel like this film is about him. But because film is often perceived as a primarily visual medium, how can we subvert that and invite people to watch a film by listening, which is often how Pedro experiences film through audio description? And if you're a sighted viewer, how do we invite you then to also listen to the film? So the intention for the blurred visuals throughout the film, which is set up in the first scene, is actually a desire to imagine what equitable enjoyment, for lack of better words, of cinema would be like, where blind viewers and sighted viewers, even though they will never experience films the same way, there's an intention that one wouldn't enjoy the film more than the other audience. And I think it's a dynamic that we're continuing to explore in our film and in cinema. And a mentor of mine, Christy Tully, shared with me this tactic where you can film without putting a lens on the camera. In essence, we got these techniques of blurred visuals by putting a gaffer's tape over the aperture of the camera, poking a hole on it, just so that the camera can capture shapes, lights, and silhouettes, in essence. But there's no way to really focus the image because there's no lens on the camera. So all this to say, Audrey, the intention for the blurred visuals of the cinematography is not so much to simulate blindness, because I think to a certain extent that's quite unethical as a non-blind person myself, but rather to invite people to experience watching a movie in a different way.
With Pedro and your relationship, as you mentioned, it's kind of a young coming of age story. How did you first meet him, and what was it about him that compelled you to start filming?
So Pedro and I met when I was helping to coordinate a program for young undocumented adults. And when I say the word young, I just kind of chuckle in my head because it took so long to make the film that we're no longer young ourselves. But at the time in 2015, when we met, there were very few, and maybe to this day still, you know, very few opportunities for undocumented young professionals to use their skill sets in a way that is congruent with the education, for example, that they've received. So that year, I was one of the coordinators, and Pedro happens to be one of the fellows, one of the participants. But what I noticed that was very unique about Pedro that morning that I met him is that he had a dog. And I realized that Pedro's dog was his guide dog, Tyler. And I think at that moment, I recognized that we don't often talk about disabled, undocumented immigrants within our movements. And that was pretty much the impetus to explore. Having been an organizer myself for a while, you know, by then, I wanted to make sure to find a way to lift up Pedro's story as an undocumented blind person. But in the course of the 6-7 years we've made the film actually wasn't just about that. And actually, maybe more than just that.
Right. I mean, there's a lot to explore in this film, a lot of big themes, a lot of interpersonal struggles and insights, you know, as you mentioned, such as the intersections of immigration, disability, and mental health, and plenty more. And within all of this, there's that underlying question that Pedro mentions of, you know, who is deserving, and the tendency to romanticize struggle. And I'm wondering for you as a filmmaker, and obviously this was such a long process, but did you have any difficulty as a filmmaker in making sure you didn't frame this film in a way that would romanticize Pedro's story in a way that didn't serve him? You know, I'm curious about what your guiding principles were.
Okay, Audrey, I love a good question. Super juicy and hearty. Thank you so much for your perceptiveness around this. Because, like, for example, the last few weeks, especially, or maybe just the last few years, immigration, has been a topic in the news, in all the wrong reasons, maybe even. And at the same time, also the experiences of blind people in particular and disabled people are not often as lifted up in the news cycle. There's like almost like this imbalance in terms of Pedro's two identities and how those are reflected in the everyday media that we consume or experience. And I think when I was making the film, from the very get-go, I told Pedro, when the film comes out and you get to experience it, I want you to be able to tell me, Seth, you understand who I am. You made a film that's literally about me. But to be able to do that, I wanted to make sure that Pedro is actually represented in the way that he understands himself. Because often I think portrayals of immigration and disability in the media, particularly blindness, is through the lens of non-disabled filmmakers, non-immigrant filmmakers, for audiences that are not from our community, also. Because as an undocumented person myself, actually, I think part of the intention why I wanted to make the film is I've watched so many movies about immigration, but I'm convinced that most of those movies, if not all of them, are portrayals of our community for the gaze, the proverbial gaze of citizens. And the reason I get that sense is because they're often through the perspective of deprivation, trauma, and how deprived our lives are, how sad we are, how deserving we are of pity, And I think for me, I wanted to make a film where undocumented immigrants and people with disabilities, particularly blind people, are thought of as the primary audiences for film, where we're creating a movie that speaks to their sensibilities beyond just their identities and the circumstances of their lives. At the end of the day, I think the desire really is how do we encapsulate the human experience so that we're not just focusing on Pedro's identity, but really the very things that people who don't even share his identities also actually go through.
Through the process of filming, 6 years and all the editing, everything that comes with it, one of Pedro's central questions was, will all of his sacrifices and hard work pay off when he has such
Oh,
limited
dun, dun, dun.
capacities, right? How has the process of this documentary and sharing it with others impacted Pedro after filming now?
I'll speak only on behalf of what I know he has communicated with me. In the film, Pedro talks a lot about being unable to really consider what the future holds. And sometimes when you're in a very precarious situation, thinking about the future can be really stressful, if not maybe even traumatizing. And I think when Pedro and I first started sharing the film with the world, actually, especially because of the political climate, I think there was a lot of hesitation. And Pedro had said that if he knew how the film would be received by people and how many screenings we would have, that it would go international broadcasts and go to film festivals all over the US. Pedro is a very shy person, so actually he always says he would have actually never done it. Because from the very beginning, Pedro was thinking that we were going to do a small film, which is also what I thought. But then our film just kept getting momentum, and it became like this snowball effect that it became an avalanche by the end. So all this to say, I think it's taken Pedro a lot of stress from the beginning, but now seeing how people respond to the film has been really affirming to him, I think. Pedro, one time there was in a screening, an audience member who is not disabled, who is not an immigrant, approached me saying, I came here to watch your film hoping to learn about another person's experience in life. Instead, I learned more about myself. I think that kind of response has been really informative for Pedro, because now he understands the power of his story and how it becomes a catalyst for people to open up about their own vulnerabilities and open up about the experiences that they don't get to show others often. And by Pedro being vulnerable, it's providing a mirror for folks to realize, look at this person showing his most vulnerable self, even though he's not always ready for it. Maybe I can do that for myself too.
Set Hernandez is the director and producer of the documentary Unseen. We spoke last year, and the film is now streaming on Peacock. And that wraps up Like Effect for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. If you've missed any of Like Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at wuwm.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, simply download the Like Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Like Effect, we'll look ahead to the Black Birth Symposium, which convenes healthcare professionals and community advocates to advance collaborations and Black birth outcomes. Thank you so much for joining us today, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.